Major funding for The Pulse is provided by a leadership gift from the Sutherland family. The Sutherlands support WHYY and its commitment to the production of programs that improve our quality of life.
This is The Pulse, stories about the people and places at the heart of health and science. I'm Maiken Scott. When I was in high school, I went on a trip to Paris with my art class. It's only like a six-hour train ride from Germany, where I was living. My mom asked me to call her as soon as we got there, and I promised I would do that. But of course, we get to Paris. It's so exciting. We just start walking all over the place. Arc de Triomphe, the Eiffel Tower, the Louvre. And then it's getting dark out, and suddenly I remember, oh, my mom. So this is the late 80s, and nobody has a cell phone, and I'm starting to look around for a payphone, but I can't find one. I'm walking and I'm walking. Suddenly, I see a phone booth. It's about two blocks away, and it's all lit up. I can see the words téléphone on the top, or however you pronounce that in French, téléphone. I have my coins. I'm ready. I pick up the receiver.
Mais arrêtez!
Stop! Yells some guy in French, and he opens the door. He says, we're filming a movie. Did you not see us?
Vous nous avez pas vu?
I look up and I look around, and yeah, there is a film crew, cameras, lights are set up. There's even some kind of fake rain thing behind the phone booth. How did I not notice that? I'm so embarrassed. The guy says, you are the third person to walk into this phone booth and to mess up our scene. I never got to call my mom that night. I think about that day often, how I saw only what I wanted to see. And I remind myself of this phone booth incident when I hear about somebody else's mistake, and I'm tempted to say, how did they miss that?
It's very easy to judge people from the outside when we're not part of the story.
On today's episode, we're looking into this phenomenon of missing something that's pretty obvious. The things we didn't see coming.
When we get it wrong, why? What is the underlying thing that happens?
And can we prevent it? When you hear a researcher talk on a show like ours or on the news, you trust that this person has been vetted, right? But sometimes that process fails. A few months ago, a story came out that a sex researcher who had been interviewed for a lot of respected news outlets was a total fraud. Liz Tung talked with the journalist who figured it all out.
His name is Jennings Brown.
Okay, how to describe my beat?
He writes for the website Gizmodo. It's a news blog that covers tech and design and science-y type stuff, though Jennings' beat is a bit more, shall we say, specialized.
Fringe communities and scam artists and all sorts of weird things that happen on the internet and in the world of technology.
Around February of 2019, Jennings got a tip to check into a guy named Damian Sendler, a young sex researcher, originally from Poland, now based in New York, whose work was getting a lot of media attention.
Yeah, if you Google him, the first things were popping up were, you know, Vice and Playboy and his interview on the Savage Lovecast.
That's the name of the hugely popular sex advice podcast hosted by columnist Dan Savage. Here's Dan introducing Damian for his appearance on the Lovecast.
He is chief of sexology and clinical research programs at Fellnet Health Research Foundation for North America.
And this was in May of 2018. Damian came on to discuss some of his recently published research.
Essentially, we looked at a study that examined bondage couples. What legally happens to people that accidentally kill their partner while performing choking?
And the interview's since been taken down, but Jennings sent me a copy. And he says that as he was listening, something about Damian just seemed off.
Yet the legal system shifts the blame from the sexual sadist to the sex slave, essentially blaming the person that died for their inability to achieve orgasm in any other way.
It wasn't the study the Jennings found weird. It was Damian himself, the way he talked, the language he used. He just didn't sound like any scientist Jennings had ever talked to. So Jennings started to dig deeper. He found out that Damien specializes in paraphilias, which are defined as abnormal sexual desires, typically involving extreme or dangerous activities.
Bestiality and necrophilia and erotic asphyxiation.
Somebody's got to study this stuff, right? But Jennings says the presentation of the research seemed weirdly salacious, like it came straight from a tabloid. For example, one of Damien's published papers focused on rectal injuries sustained by people who'd had sex with animals, among other things I can't say on the air. Another one, which got lots of media play, included some pretty graphic interviews with necrophiliacs. Jennings was skeptical, so he shared the study with David Lay, a clinical psychologist who focuses on sexual health.
And he was like, these scenarios are, they read like penthouse letters. Like this, nothing about this feels real.
And there was something else that was bothering Jennings. He couldn't seem to find any evidence of Damien's credentials.
Immediately, like, things weren't adding up. His timeline seemed a little off, and just the amount that he had accomplished.
Damien was 28 years old, and according to his bio, he'd already earned his MD and PhD from Harvard, thank you very much. He'd won a President's Gold Service Award for his contributions in medicine and mental health, was chief of sexology at a nonprofit health research foundation based in New York, and was one of the youngest elected members of the American Psychiatric Association and the American Academy of Psychiatry and the Law. But when Jennings got on the phone to confirm these credentials, they didn't check out. So Jennings decides to contact Damien, get the story directly from the horse's mouth.
I reached out to him to ask if he would do an interview, and he was completely down.
So they set up an interview. And the next week, Damien shows up at the Gizmodo office.
The first thing I noticed when he was waiting in the lobby, he was just impeccably dressed, like wearing this Donegal blazer.
He had on a tie clip.
He had this pattern pocket square and a fabric flower.
Strong cologne.
And he just had this presence that, you know, he stood out immediately.
So they go upstairs. And before Jennings can even begin asking questions, Damien launches into a monologue about his research.
And then he like started saying how he wanted to study like the theoretical scenario in which a large sex party or like the New York Pride Parade leads to an increase in HIV infections.
And yet there was something compelling about Damien, the way he delivered his message.
He was so confident. I mean, he seemed very excited about these ideas and just kind of barreling through and not even giving you a chance to really process it or ask questions.
But Jennings' silence was strategic, too. He was waiting for just the right moment to bring up Damien's shady credentials.
And then finally, he mentioned, like, I think it was like the third time he mentioned that he had gotten his PhD and his MD from Harvard.
Jennings decided to pounce.
And I was like, but you didn't attend Harvard Medical School. And he sort of, it was the first time he kind of short-circuited almost, like didn't know how to respond. And he kind of tilted his head and was like, oh, what? Sure. Yeah. And I was like, but I called the registrar and you didn't attend the medical school. And then he kind of recalibrated and he was like, well, it was like this kind of diverse path. You know, I did some in Europe and some here, and it started to get really confusing.
Eventually, Damien told Jennings that it was true he hadn't gotten his MD and PhD from Harvard, that was the invention of his publicist, who Jennings says he hasn't been able to confirm is actually a real person. Jennings asks him about the other stuff, the awards he'd won, the research institute he claimed to lead. He hammered away at Damien. And that process continued for weeks after their interview.
I mean, it was kind of this perpetual, like, you know, I'd find something weird and then ask him about it. And then he would present this other lie that I would then have to fact check. And it almost became this, it was this, such a weird noodly salad of fact checking.
But in the end, all of Damien's efforts couldn't stop Jennings. On March 1st, Gizmodo published an article entitled "The Fake Sex Doctor Who Conned the Media into Publicizing His Bizarre Research on Suicide, Butt Fisting, and Bestiality." And it went viral. At least a dozen publications picked it up. There was lots of soul searching on behalf of journalists, wondering how they'd been tricked. Damien, by the way, disputes a lot of this. He posted and took down several defenses on his website, DamienSendler.com. Aside from that, Damien kind of dropped out of the public eye. So I was kind of surprised when I emailed him and he actually agreed to an interview.
You know, I really felt that the story was sort of mistold and misrepresented.
Damien said that's why he was speaking out now. He said I'd contacted him at a good time, that he was willing to talk with media again to essentially clear his name.
You know, I also wanted to kind of, you know, figure out what actually happened and what is the controversy.
According to him, this whole thing is a case of professional assassination. He said other researchers are jealous of him because he's young and successful, and that Jennings was motivated by clicks. But on a larger scale, Damien seems to see the whole incident as evidence of the global anti-science movement, part of the bigger pattern of people doubting science and scientists in general. As for why he was targeted, Damien says it's because of his controversial research. And he positions himself as a cautionary tale for other scientists.
This is such a dangerous precedent. Whatever, if someone doesn't like you, you know, they can just file a false report. And you have to go through scrutiny that, you know, could end up in a different way.
Damien did admit that he doesn't have degrees from Harvard. He said claiming that was a huge mistake. However, he said he does have a PhD and is about to finish his MD, though he wouldn't tell me where.
So I don't want to talk about that now because there's a lot of, you know, news reports that have conflicting information. I just decided not going to discuss it for now.
Damien didn't seem inclined to admit to any of the other allegations that Jennings made. But Jennings says there was one point when Damien came close. It was near the end of the interview. Jennings had challenged Damien on all his credentials. Damien had stonewalled him. And then finally, Jennings asked a question.
Where do you draw the line between marketing and misrepresenting your credentials? It was almost like this mask came off and he was finally like looking at me eye to eye.
Here's the tape from their actual interview.
Where's the line between like marketing and misrepresentation of your credentials?
Well, again, that's sort of subjective, right? Isn't everyone sort of, you know, misrepresenting themselves in every way, right? Like, I don't know you, right? You might be working here today, but you might not work here tomorrow, right? And, like, you know, I might, you know, try to, you know, feel intimidated by you today, but tomorrow you don't have a job, right? And I still have mine, right? So it's highly subjective, right? And you have to understand that in the world where people use, you know, even like the president of this country uses Twitter and creates falsehoods every day, right? You have to think to yourself about, okay, you know, how do we then quantify the degree of guilt that you can do, right? Because you see, if the most powerful man can do this, you know, 8,000-9,000 times through fact-checking, and you guys do it all the time, and he doesn't care, you know, he still does his thing and people still support him because they believe in the agenda that he executes partly, right? The same happens, I think, to all of us.
It seemed pretty direct that he was saying, I mean, it doesn't really matter now if you are falsifying your credentials. It just matters what you create and what you can get people to believe. And he said, reality is inflatable.
Damien said something similar when we talked, that in this world where there's so many voices, so many claims and representations, what the truth is what we want it to be.
Regardless of who you're going to believe, me, Jennings, yourself, I think you need to look at multiple sources. So I think that when it comes to finding authority, you have to look deep inside your heart and really think about what do you want to believe in.
For The Pulse, I'm Liz Tung.
So, how are people like Damien Sendler so nonchalant about bending the truth, about inflating credentials, changing their story? Psychologist Maria Konnikova spent lots of time interviewing grifters and con artists for her book, The Confidence Game. And she says many grifters are Machiavellian. They persuade people to do what's in their own best interest. And they're also narcissists. They feel like the rules don't apply to them.
I deserve this. And what's more, I deserve it more than you do. So con artists often use this to justify what they do because they say, I'm actually not doing anything wrong. I'm not stealing from anyone. I'm just righting the wrongs of the world. I'm taking what's rightfully mine.
And Maria says, if you're thinking, I would never fall for that kind of thing, I'm not gullible, watch out.
It's very easy to judge people from the outside when we're not part of the story, because it's very easy to be objective about other people. The moment it's you, you become subjective because emotion comes into the picture. You are emotionally invested in the story that the con artist is selling you. And the number one thing that con artists do when they hook you into their story is they engage you emotionally. They make you a protagonist in whatever it is they're selling. And they're selling you something that you actually want to believe in.
So if you think about Damien Sendler, how come no other journalist than Jennings Brown checked his credentials before interviewing him? I mean, that's supposed to be part of the job. Generally, though, Maria says that's just not human nature.
The majority of the world is comprised of not con artists, but people who are telling you the truth. And so the way the human brain works is we are basically wired to trust and to believe that what the other person says is true, because otherwise, can you imagine living where you have to verify every single thing every single person said? So when you meet someone, you know, at a party, or when you meet someone in a social setting and they say, oh, you know, my name is Maria, and oh, you went to Harvard, I went to Harvard too. You don't start thinking, oh, is this really Maria? Did she really go to Harvard? You can't call up Harvard and say, hey, can I have a transcript for this person to see if they actually went there? Well, you can, but you'd be a little bit crazy to do so.
Maria Konnikova is a psychologist and author. She has written The Confidence Game. Here's a mistake that seems to happen often with innovation: not knowing your audience. Some visually impaired people use a cane to help them get around. It's usually white to make it super visible for others and to also signal that the user can't see. For more than 50 years, people have tried to re-engineer this cane to make it, quote, smart, to add more functions. There's the Ultra Cane, the K-Sonar, the C5 Laser Cane. Yet none of these have come close to replacing the standard white cane. Why not? Steph Yin looked into this.
Which way are we going to go, Kennedy?
Kennedy, Dowd, and Ethan are practicing their navigation skills.
All right, so we're going to take the covered pit.
So think
boys.
About where you are. Okay, think about where the door to exit is.
At the Overbrook School for the Blind in West Philadelphia, each student is paired with an orientation and mobility instructor who helps them learn the white cane. There are multiple ways to use a cane. Kennedy likes to sweep hers back and forth, maintaining constant contact with the ground. While Dowd and Ethan prefer a two-point touch, tapping left and right as they walk. It's a matter of personal preference, and the instructors work in whichever style each student wants. As we're walking, Ethan loses his bearings a bit. With the help of his instructor, Amanda, he thinks through where he is.
Hey, what cluster are you in?
The East Cloister.
East Cloister. So where's the library?
Down the ramp. Over to the left.
Over to the left. There you go.
Around the world, the white cane has become a symbol of self-reliance and dignity for people who are blind. But it has its limits.
Sometimes I have trouble getting around people or finding certain objects.
The cane can't detect obstacles that are far away. It leaves the upper body vulnerable to overhangs.
Tree branches are a serious thing for everybody here.
It can miss drop-offs, like curbs. It can get caught on things.
My cane gets a little bit stuck.
In the grass, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's hard to use your cane in the grass. It gets stuck in those cracks, right? Sometimes, yeah.
It does.
Maybe because of these challenges, only an estimated 2 to 8% of people who are visually impaired actually use white canes. The rest rely on other people, guide dogs, or their usable vision. About 85 to 90% of people who are blind or visually impaired have some low level of sight. The question is, could there be a better cane? One that more people want to use? For decades, inventors have tried to use whatever new tech is out there, sonar, ultrasound, GPS, artificial intelligence, to up the function of the plain white cane. Shlomi Hanasi knows all about that. He lives in Israel, and he's a bit of a mad inventor. About a decade ago, he was a student working in a lab on a device called the eye cane. It used infrared rays to detect obstacles within 5 meters and communicated with users through sound and vibrations. It was a promising technology. Previous devices were slow at detecting and communicating obstacles, but the eye cane...
It was fast enough, okay? So it was actually useful and was different from other instruments.
Shlomi's team also showed that it took blind people less time to learn how to use the eye cane than other devices. They got a lot of media coverage.
It worked very well. You can read a lot of articles that show that.
But good press aside, a lot of people who are blind are skeptical of technologies invented by sighted people like Shlomi. For instance, Daniel Kish. He doesn't see any need for a smart cane. Daniel lives in Southern California. He's been blind since he was a baby, when he had both of his eyes removed due to a rare eye cancer called retinoblastoma. But very early on, he found his own way of getting around.
I began clicking and using and developing my own form of sonar right after I lost my second eye.
Daniel started using echolocation, or sonar vision. He would make sounds, usually by clicking his tongue.
A quiet click might sound like this, but it can go quite loud.
Sometimes he'd also snap his fingers or clap his hands. And he'd listen to how the sound came back to him to get the texture, size, and shape of objects.
Then I got around pretty well. I walked to school myself. I got around my community myself.
Brain scans have found that when people like Daniel use echolocation in lieu of sight, they're actually using their visual cortex, the brain region that processes sensory information from our eyes.
It'll reconnect and rewire itself to wherever it needs to gather the data it needs.
In his late teens, Daniel wanted to do more stuff, so he learned how to use a cane, and that helped him even more. Echolocating helped him with objects at head and shoulder level, and the cane took care of what was at his feet.
And so my perceptual system became a kind of seamless dynamic. I've hiked the Swiss Alps with my cane, and I'm one of those who likes to hike alone.
A big part of his technique is allowing the cane to become an extension of oneself. Think of a rat's whiskers.
Rat's whiskers have certain qualities. They're very delicate, they're light, they're flexible, they're conductive. So we try to simulate that, if you will, with a cane. The lighter and more delicate the touch, the more information you're able to receive.
And that's one of Daniel's main gripes with smart canes. He says, the minute you start adding batteries, sensors, and buttons to a cane, you start interfering with all this.
One of the things that happens, of course, is you make the cane heavier. You change the balance of the cane.
Plus, Daniel says, all the sound and vibratory cues can be distracting. And electronics make a cane more difficult to maintain. You have to charge it. The tech can malfunction.
This thing is going to be susceptible to weather. It's going to be susceptible to dirt.
Not to mention, smart canes can cost hundreds of dollars more than a regular white cane. Most importantly, Daniel worries that fixating on electronics will shift focus away from building a good foundation in orientation and mobility. Just think about how over-relying on Google Maps has made all of us worse at getting around on our own. But there are other people, like Kirshat Ceylan, who want a better cane. Kirshat is from Turkey and has been blind since birth. And he thinks, why not use tech that's here to our advantage?
Do visually impaired people need improvement in their daily life? Yes, I do. At least I do.
Kirshat has worked on many different technologies for the visually impaired, including a media platform, a navigation tool for shopping centers, and an interface that provides audio descriptions for movies. His latest project is the WeWalk, a new smart cane. It ultrasonically detects overhead obstacles. It also integrates with a user's smartphone and syncs up with apps like Google Maps or Amazon's Alexa. He said the effort arose from his own needs. For example, Kirshat says when he's waiting at the bus stop, he's always asking other people to let him know when his bus, number 43, arrives.
And also, while we are walking in the street, we don't know the name of the stores, or we don't know the color of the traffic lights. And these are the problems that we have to solve. Visually impaired people can be independent. We believe that.
Kershaw does acknowledge the points that some blind people make against smart canes.
We have to accept that smart canes are heavier than the regular canes. But we should focus on if the heavier cane give me much more confidence, much more ability to travel easier, then I can prefer the heavier cane.
Daniel Kish, the echolocator, says it's promising that more blind people are leading tech development. He says that makes a difference.
So historically, a lot of these technologies were developed by sighted people. You cannot understand blindness from a sighted perspective.
Daniel says the problem is sighted people can never fully grasp blind people's experiences.
They make, I'll call them guesses about not seeing.
And often what's fueling those guesses are stigma, fear, anxiety.
Most people are afraid of blindness. They feel it's among the top four worst things that could happen to them, right alongside of terminal illness, cancer and such. When you look at information that is presented around various technologies and devices, it very much emphasizes what the blind person cannot do or won't be able to do. So there is a very much kind of, we need to fix this mentality. I think that the whole perspective needs to be shifted from an assumption of deficit to an expectation of capacity.
Remember Shlomi Hanasi, the inventor in Israel who was working on the eye cane? He eventually learned this lesson in his own way. During the time he was working on the eye cane, he happened to come across a cat on the street during a run one day.
Because I was living in a village with a lot of jackals that came out at night, I thought it was a newborn jackal. So I gave it the name Zevon, which means wolfie.
Shlomi took Zevon home with him and soon realized the cat was blind. Since he was already working on the eye cane, he got to work making a wearable device that would detect obstacles for Zevon. But then,
as much as I wanted to help this cat with time, I saw that it can manage by itself and it have actually more skills than I will ever thought to have myself.
Zevon was fine staying home alone. He could expertly maneuver around the furniture.
He was able to jump everywhere.
The experience taught Shlomi a bigger lesson, that people who can see often miss the ways that the blind adapt and develop their own ways of being in this world.
Because we don't know how easy to be blind, we cannot understand usually the other senses so well.
He says this illustrates a broader problem with tech, that often developers try to create solutions for others based on assumptions without taking the time to understand people.
That story was reported by Steph Yin. We're talking about the things we miss, blind spots, mistakes that could be avoided. Sometimes when we want to make something better, we end up making things worse. There are these unintended consequences that seem to pop up. Reporter Nina Feldman came across an example of that. Hey, Nina.
Hi, Maiken.
So what was this example you found?
Yeah, so we have all heard of OxyContin, right? Prescription opioid that was very heavily prescribed and is now known to be super addictive.
And it's been named one of the culprits in the opioid epidemic, right?
Absolutely. And part of that is because back in the day, it was really easy to misuse OxyContin. You could crush it up and people developed addictions that way. And as a way to try to stop that from happening, in 2010, the company that makes OxyContin actually changed the way that the drug was formulated to make it harder to abuse.
And then what happened?
So a recent study looked at the states where OxyContin abuse was really high back in the early 2000s. And then it looked at those same states after OxyContin was reformulated to be harder to abuse. And what the researchers found is that, yes, OxyContin misuse went way down in those places after the drug was reformulated. But in those same places, rates of heroin overdose deaths and of hepatitis C were through the roof. And both of those things are kind of evidence of increased injection drug use.
So it looks like people didn't give up that behavior. They just found a different way to go about it.
Exactly. And with the opioid epidemic, everyone is looking for ways out of the crisis that we're in. Everyone's looking for a solution. And this just got me thinking, you know, with that sense of urgency, are there other well-intentioned efforts that maybe we've rushed into to curb prescription drugs that just end up sort of backfiring? And that's when I met Kevin.
Can you introduce yourself for me?
My name is Kevin. I'm a recovering... Should I do that?
If you want to.
He was in his 20s, graduated from college, had a good job, close with his family.
It was a sunny day and a storm blew in.
And then a bad car crash changed everything.
I broke a bunch of bones in my body.
He herniated two discs in his back. And this is where Kevin's story starts to sound familiar. We're not going to use his last name because he mentions a lot of illegal activity. Kevin was prescribed Oxycontin for his pain at first, then Percocet.
And that went on for about 2.5 years.
One day, he ran out of his prescription and couldn't get away from work to get it refilled.
Finished my prescription on Friday morning, and by Sunday night, I was going through the withdrawals, which is like hot and cold sweats, anxiety, nausea, vomiting.
Kevin's doctor explained to him that he'd developed a physical dependency on the drugs and they needed to wean him off.
It was pretty abrupt, to be honest, and like caught me off guard.
Kevin's doctors prescribed him Suboxone to try to help to ease the withdrawal symptoms as they lowered his dose. But Kevin says he still craved the drugs. So he started getting prescription pain pills on his own.
I was able to purchase the prescription on the street and way more than what the doctor was giving me. And I was prescribed like 4 30s a day.
That's 4 Percocets, 30 milligrams each.
And once I did it on my own, I got up to like 20 a day. Eventually, once the money wasn't there, it turned into heroin. And it's been like on and off for the last 6 years.
Stories like Kevin's are echoed in public health campaigns.
He was given pain pills by his doctor.
I was prescribed at 15 years old.
I was 19 years old, pregnant with my second child.
Lawyers use these narratives to sue Big Pharma, and the message to doctors is loud and clear.
For too long, too many doctors have been writing too many prescriptions of opioids, and people have become addicted to opioids from those prescriptions.
That is Philadelphia Health Commissioner Tom Farley. Philly has the highest overdose death rate of any major city in the country, and Tom's office has been doubling down on efforts to curb opioid prescriptions.
The average number of pills that people get for opioids after surgery right now, for example, is 40, and most patients could use zero.
He says it's working. His department has issued a bunch of guidances to doctors, and the number of Medicaid opioid prescriptions has been cut in half in the last 2 years.
Our main guidance is about how to manage people who are not currently taking opioids. We don't want them to get started on these drugs in the first place. We don't want them to get addicted in these drugs in the first place.
And now, all states have these databases that track prescription opioids. They're designed to catch people who might be getting prescriptions from more than one doctor, or doctors that are prescribing too many pills. The idea here is that it's prescription drugs that got us into this mess, so limiting them will get us out of it. Let's prevent future Kevins from becoming addicted. But limiting prescriptions to stop addiction is kind of a blunt instrument.
So most people that misuse prescription opioids do not transition to heroin or illicit drugs. They either quit or they continue to misuse prescription drugs solely.
That's Wilson Compton. He's second in command at the National Institute on Drug Abuse. He says only between 8 and 10% of people who are prescribed opioids for chronic pain develop an opioid use disorder. Even less start using heroin. On top of that, research shows that most people who do become addicted to opioids weren't prescribed them. They got the pills from a friend or family member or off the street. So these stop prescribing opioids approaches would likely prevent future Kevins. But what about all the Kevins out there right now who are already addicted? In 2017, that was almost 2 million people. In the short term, these policies might actually hurt those people. Here's what happened to Kevin when his doctors weaned him off his prescription.
I still wanted to, I guess, to feel the feeling, and my body was telling me I was in more pain than I actually was. So I went out and sought the painkillers on my own.
Eventually, Kevin started injecting heroin instead of taking pills orally or snorting them. Injection drug use comes at a lot higher risk.
Yeah, I wound up losing like everything. I lost my job. I lost a girl I was with.
Kevin ended up homeless. He sold drugs on the corner to make money to buy more. He overdosed 6 times. He contracted hepatitis C.
For like 6 years, my life was just like a nightmare.
Kevin says none of the doctors talked to him about these risks or about addiction treatment when they weaned him off the prescription opioids. They just told him it was necessary because he had become dependent.
I guess I kind of had like a bitter taste in my mouth towards the physicians, but like at the same time, like, you know, pain medication was required for the accident and everything.
And so a bitter taste for them sort of letting you go on for that long on the prescription or for weaning you off so fast?
Yeah.
Kevin's cravings didn't just disappear. He found another way, a cheaper, more dangerous way, to satisfy them. Here's Wilson Compton from the National Institute on Drug Abuse again.
If you have a patient who requests prescriptions, so has some drug seeking, it makes a clinician suspicious that there's problematic use of those medications. Simply cutting them off and refusing to write that particular prescription is very short-sighted.
There are a lot of addiction treatment options out there for people, but most doctors who prescribe opioids are internal medicine or family doctors. They're not trained in addiction medicine. It might be easier for them to say, "We're just going to taper you off," than to have a tough conversation about treatment, especially because there's a lot on the line for doctors. Remember those programs designed to make sure that doctors aren't prescribing too many opioids? Well, medical boards and law enforcement keep an eye on those, and doctors know that.
In the back of their minds, they're thinking, okay, how is this going to make me look on the prescription drug monitoring program?
Leo Beletsky is a researcher who studies these programs in Boston.
You know, is this going to make me look bad? Is this going to make me look suspicious?
He says when doctors know the law is watching, they might have more incentive to get patients off their roster than to get them into treatment. Okay, so even if all this is true, what are we supposed to do? Just let prescription painkillers flow freely? Here's Tom Farley in Philly again.
Let's remember, as much as we may have some concerns about patients being rapidly reduced, that staying where we are right now is not the right solution either. We are in an absolute crisis situation right now. So people's concern about what's the dangers of the future, we have the danger of the present that we need to respond to.
That story was reported by Nina Feldman. We're talking about blind spots, things we didn't see coming, things we missed. When it comes to medical errors, the stakes are high. People's lives are at risk. We often hear about the worst kind of medical errors, where a surgeon operated on the wrong arm or the wrong leg, or a patient died because they were given the wrong medication. But neurologist Jonathan Howard says a lot of times mistakes happen on a smaller scale. A misdiagnosis, the test that wasn't ordered, the test that wasn't needed. And Jonathan spends a lot of time thinking about this.
When we get it wrong, why? What is the underlying thing that happens?
Jonathan is a neurologist and psychiatrist at Bellevue Hospital in New York City, so he's a brain guy. And he says a lot of times unconscious biases and cognitive blind spots are at play. For example,
so there was a gentleman who came to the psychiatric emergency room from a drug rehabilitation center, and he had just sort of stopped talking for a day or so. And everyone assumed that he was kind of high or that he was just really angry. I shook his hand and he squeezed my hand really hard. And I thought, boy, this guy's kind of kind of being a jerk. He urinated on himself in the emergency room and he spent a few hours there. And then someone felt, boy, you know, this isn't right. We should get an image on him. And we got a head CT and he'd actually had a small stroke in the left anterior cerebral artery territory. And that explained all of his findings. So had that patient not come from a drug rehabilitation center, had he been a businessman who was found at his office, had he not been taken immediately to the psychiatric part of the hospital, had he been taken to the medical part of the hospital, his condition might have been discovered sooner. And that's the sort of thing that you see all the time. A very quick identifying piece of information about a patient completely distorts your perception. And if you deny that, well, you're probably not being honest with yourself.
So you put them in a drawer And then you treat them according to that drawer you've put them in.
You can't help it. That's sort of the point. And when if I was to just give you names, for example, you would have automatic association based on those names and all sorts of mannerisms about a person, how they dress, how they behave, really influence your perception of them, whether you want them to or not.
So what do we do about it? I mean, we have to go on information that we've collected over time, right, to make decisions. We can't start from scratch every time we see a patient.
I don't think that you can just sort of sit there and say, okay, I'm really, really going to think hard about this. Because by definition, if you could sit there and reason your way out or just think a little bit harder about some of these errors that you are making, they would no longer be blind spots. I do think that there are a few things to do. And the first of these is be humble and ask for help. And it's wise, I think, to work in teams when possible. One thing about learning about cognitive biases and errors that doctors make is it makes you sometimes pretty good at picking up mistakes that other doctors make. So I can see sometimes errors that other doctors make that they can't. And then the reverse is true. My friends and colleagues can see errors that I make.
Yeah, but then there's the issue of hierarchy, too, in hospitals.
Right, so you just have to create a culture where people are not afraid to speak up. So one technique to do this is to create a devil's advocate, which is sort of what it sounds like, to say to one person during rounds, your job today is to say everything I do is wrong. And that frees the person up from thinking, oh, I don't want to contradict Dr. Howard. I don't want to, you know, step outside of my mold and break the hierarchy. So to do that, frankly, as a doctor, not be a jerk and say, how dare you contradict me? If I found out that one of the junior doctors thought I was making a mistake and didn't speak up, I would be quite upset.
When you talk to other doctors about this, these blind spots and these traps we all fall into, how do they react? Do they like this?
Well, I think they do what I do. They think that it's very interesting, but they also think I don't do that, which is, of course, not the case. And that's one danger about learning about these biases is you think, I don't do that. I won't do that. Or, sure, sometimes I do that, but not often. That's what the other guy does. And this has been studied. Almost every doctor thinks they're above average.
So just being aware does not do the trick. Jonathan is first to admit that.
I have definitely made some of the mistakes that I describe absolutely perfectly, unfortunately.
Jonathan Howard is a neurologist and psychiatrist. His book is Cognitive Errors and Diagnostic Mistakes, a case-based guide to critical thinking in medicine. Sometimes we don't question things because they are written down. It's on the record, so it must be true. When Netta Freya was 13, an entry was added to her medical record because she had a strange reaction to an antibiotic.
I just remember being in my house and looking down on my legs, and they were itchy, and I had red hives all over them. And then from then on, I had a penicillin allergy in my medical chart. It just followed me everywhere I went.
About 30 million Americans have a documented penicillin allergy, and that means for them, most of the commonly prescribed antibiotics are off limits.
So in essence, the first line choice for most of our very common infections are not an option anymore. And so a person with a penicillin allergy often has to get second line antibiotics or even much broader spectrum, more powerful antibiotics that can have lots of very powerful and bad side effects.
Netta is a family medicine doctor now, and she saw this allergy note pop up on patients' charts often. Then her son was diagnosed with a penicillin allergy.
He had just like an ear infection and was on amoxicillin.
So, like, when I was 4, I had a rash because I was taking penicillin.
Just a red, bumpy rash all over his body. And as in most cases, that's enough for the person to be told, okay, you're allergic to penicillin. And that went right on his chart, too.
But it turns out that
neither of us is allergic to penicillin.
How did you find that out?
So I think, as is so often the case in parenthood, I was more invested in my son's long-term well-being than I was in my own. And I thought, you know, I really don't want him to have this label on his chart. I don't want this world of potentially excellent medications to not be available to him for the rest of his life. And so I took him to see an allergist.
So I went to the doc, a nice woman, and she told me, like, what was going to happen.
And he went through a pretty simple skin testing procedure. They gave him one pill of amoxicillin afterwards when he passed the skin test, and he didn't have a reaction. So that label was totally taken off of his chart. He is not allergic to penicillin.
Netta went through the same skin test and got the same result. And as she dug into more research, she found out this is really common.
We've actually learned in medicine that 95% of people who have a reported penicillin allergy are not allergic to penicillin.
She said that reaction she had as a teenager, that itchy rash, could have been from anything. Also, people sometimes outgrow these allergies. So what should physicians, and I'm thinking it's probably most likely primary care physicians who should know about this, what should physicians do differently?
I think one of the most important things is that when we see that penicillin allergy on a patient's chart, to ask more questions about it. We often treat that allergy tab as if it's written in stone, whereas other parts of the chart we're constantly updating and things are coming off and being added on. We should view that allergy tab with that same fluidity. So ask more questions. What actually happened? How old were you? In some cases, the reaction really is severe. They might have had their skin slough off of their body. That's serious, and that warrants more of like a closer investigation. But if it was that they had hives when they were 13, like me, then we could actually really think about sending them for testing and maybe taking that off of their chart.
And not having or being able, in quotes, to take those medications can have some pretty serious drawbacks, right?
Absolutely. There have actually been a number of studies that have shown that people with a reported penicillin allergy have a higher risk of really serious complications, like, for example, MRSA, that resistant staph infection, also C. diff or Clostridium difficile colitis, which can make a person incredibly sick. People with penicillin allergy have a higher risk of those kinds of infections. And so it's not a harmless thing to just kind of linger in your history for years and years.
And what's the reason for those bigger infections? Is that because they were treated with stronger antibiotics along the way?
That's exactly right. Yes.
Netta Freya is an internal medicine physician and host of the Primary Care Reviews and Perspectives podcast. That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Alan Yu, Liz Tung, Jad Slayman, and Steph Yin. Andreas Copes is our intern. We had production assistance from Julian Harris. Charlie Kyer is our engineer. Lindsay Lazarski is our producer. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.
Behavioral health reporting on The Pulse is supported by the Thomas Scattergood Behavioral Health Foundation, an organization that is committed to thinking, doing, and supporting innovative approaches in integrated healthcare. WHYY's health and science reporting is supported by a generous grant from the Public Health Management Corporation's Public Health Fund. PHMC gladly supports WHYY and its commitment to the production of services that improve our quality of life.